The following live presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman is brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To learn more about Israelite, please visit our website at www.israelite.org. Additional contact information is available at the end of this presentation. Thank you for learning with Israelite and enjoy the experience.
By the way, the Kinneret, which we're going to see in a minute, the Sea of Galilee, does anybody know why it's called the Kinneret? So most people will tell you because it's shaped like a kinnor, like a harp. But if you look at the sea, it's not really shaped like a harp. The real reason is because there's a low tree called the Kinnar, which actually used to be used for making ropes. And it grows indigenously along the banks of the Kinneret. So the Kinneret is really the sea, the lake. If you look on your left, what you are seeing once again is the fulfillment of a prophecy. By the way, everything up in these hills, every yeshuv, every kibbutz, every planted, cultivated field was planted here since 1967. The Syrians have this as a closed military zone. In fact, we have intelligence communications to that effect. All the fields that are planted, you can see more sunflowers on your left, have been planted since the Six-Day War. There are approximately 20,000 Jews now that live up on the Golan Heights. Every town, every village, every house that is built today was built since 67. And before 1967, this was one huge military base. The Syrians had intended that this should be a staging ground for the eventual destruction of Israel. And, you know, the Pesach says in Isaiah, you know, that one day the fields of war will become the products of peace. So that's what you're looking at. Now you're looking at the width of the Golan Heights. Okay? You look to your right, you can see Syria off in the distance. The narrowest point of the Golan Heights that's controlled by Israel is 9 kilometers. Okay, 9 kilometers is about 5 miles. So you could walk it in an hour. Okay? You could walk from one edge of the Golan Heights to the Syrian border in an hour. So a tank that crossed through the border could be overlooking the Kinneret in about 10 minutes. Where do we stand on giving this back? Ehud Barak was talking about giving away the Golan Heights as part of an agreement with Syria. That was back in the days of Hafez Assad, the father. And he got so far along in the negotiations, people started to get scared. Rabin also was talking about this. There was a massive movement, Ha'am Yim HaGolan, that the people are with the Golan. And that plan didn't work for various reasons, not least of which was that Syria wasn't willing to sit down. At the time of Barak, there were secret negotiations between Syria and Barak, and they had what they thought was an agreement hammered out. And then Clinton met with Assad in Switzerland, and he made him an offer that he was sure Assad wouldn't be able to refuse, which was a financial offer of what they would build and what they would help him rebuild if Syria signed the agreement that Israel told him they had pretty much agreed to. And at the last minute, Assad said he didn't just want the Golan Heights. He wanted to go back to the borders of June 4th, 1967, which include an area on the Kinneret that Syria took illegally after 1948 by testing the waters and taking over an Israeli police station along the Kinneret border. Well, Israel wasn't going to give Syria access to the Kinneret, which is our only natural source of water. So everything fell through. This place here, what we're doing, this is called Mitzpeh Shalom. It sits alongside a village called Kfar Charuv. Kfar Charuv was actually a village that existed in the time of the Talmud. We'll get to that later. They actually built all these beautiful guest houses here in 1999. They were sure that they were going to have an influx of tourists. And then everything exploded. Now people are finally starting to come back. So we're going to pull in here. They built an overlook called Mitzpeh Shalom, Peace Viewpoint. And they did this back in the days when it looked like peace was breaking out. Oslo, Jordan peace agreement, we already have with Egypt. They were waiting for it to come through with Syria. So they thought one day the Syrians will come up with the Israelis and they'll look down in the valley and they'll talk of peace. Unfortunately, that has not yet come. Okay, we're going to get off here. There's a little cafe. Come over to the view and I'll break out my map and I'll give you a little talk about what we're looking at. Sorry guys, this way. Apologies. Yeah, isn't that amazing? Gorgeous up here. Take a big square and sit around, big enough so everybody can sit in the... Come grab a seat on the floor. Grab a seat. It's okay. It's good for you. Come grab a seat. You can lean against the pillar if you want. Any questions? We're definitely not done.
How come we haven't heard about that?
You know when you'll know you're done? When the 12 tribes have returned, the Beis HaMikdash is built, we have prophets, then you can rest easy because they'll let us know if there's a problem again. You know what it's like? It's like, imagine your daughter has a brain tumor, and your other son gets a cut in his thumb. You don't really spend much time talking about a cut in his thumb. It's still an issue. It's just, you know, Syria is not serious about peace right now. They're being pressured. All right, so we'll start. I'll fill him in afterwards. All right, you look behind me, and when we stand up, and there's three things you can see very clearly. It goes without saying that this is the Kinneret. Okay, those are the edges of the mountain of Gilboa that we pointed out before. Gilboa. That's the edge of them. Okay? You can see very clearly the city of Tiberias. We're going to be there tonight. But by the time we get there tonight, you're going to be too tired to hear about it. So I'll tell you a couple of things. One is that the Rambam is buried in Tiberia. Now that's an interesting story because the Rambam died in Egypt. So how did the Rambam get to Israel to be buried? So some people have the opinion that the Rambam said it like today. You know, you're a Jew, you're a great rabbi, you die, you want to be buried in Israel, they get you to Israel. But there is a legend that's an amazing legend. It's one of those legends actually that appears in a number of different places. But the Rambam Maimonides lived from 1105 or 1110.
1135 to 1204.
No, I think it was 1110, but I could be wrong. We'll look it up. But it was still 1204. I could be wrong. We'll look it up. But he basically spanned the 12th century. He was born, he grew up in Spain, actually in Cordoba. He was forced into hiding as a boy when the Almohades attacked the city of Cordoba and, you know, became Muslim. And that was during the period of time that the Jews were caught between the Catholics and the Spanish. I'm not going to get too much into the story because we could sit here for an hour on the story, but I don't want you to miss the Golan. But on the bus afterwards, if you're curious, I'll be glad to tell you about it. But in a nutshell, the Rambam hid out in a cave. He wrote actually the Perush of the Mishnayot. It's called the Rambam's Perush of Mishnayot. They're commenting the entire Mishnah, all six sections of the Mishnah. According to the legend, he wrote this by the time he was 17. Be depressed. And that was just the beginning. And he wrote the Yadah Chazaka, all of Halacha, all of whatever. Anyway, so the Rambam died in Egypt. He was actually the doctor of the Sultan, right? And he went to different places. So the question is how he got to Israel. So one opinion is that he got to Israel because, you know, they brought his body to Israel. The other opinion is he got to Israel because they knew he wanted to be buried in Israel, but they didn't know how to get in there because there was a war on. Israel at the time was crusader. They were living in a Muslim territory. So they decided that they would just put his coffin on the Nile and let God take him there. And somehow, the coffin floated off and ended up floating into the shores of the Kinneret. Now, you and I know that that's not possible because the Nile doesn't connect. The Nile doesn't even connect to the Mediterranean. It certainly doesn't connect to the Kinneret. But you know what? It's a Rambam. And the Ari, actually, the Ari HaKadosh, the way that we know all the grave... Well, you know what? Remind me on the bus. I'll tell you about the grave of the Rambam. But, pardon? We know that this is the grave of the Rambam. How that is for the bus. Anyway, the Rambam is buried there. More interesting to me, Rabbi Akiva. You've heard of Rabbi Akiva. Now we're going back 1,000 years earlier. Rabbi Akiva, it's interesting. Rabbi Akiva was, you may know the story, he lived during the Bar Kokhba Rebellion. He was captured by Hadrian, caught teaching Torah. He was put to death, tortured to death. His skin was combed with iron combs. He is famous for having for smiling and laughing as they torture him to death because he suddenly realizes that he has this tremendous opportunity to fulfill the mitzvah of loving God with all your heart and your soul. And there's a very deep message. You know, we get all stuck on this stuff. you know, wars, people get killed, it's so heavy. I want you to know, if life ends, when life ends, then you're right, it's depressing. But this is just a portal. If life ends, okay, when life ends, you know, when a person dies, then you're right, it's depressing. Especially depressing if a person dies young, because if all you have is 70, 80 years and you die at 20, that's depressing. But if this life is just a portal to something much more, it's not depressing at all. It's like you're standing in line for the movie theater and somebody cuts the line. And he gets up to the ticket booth and he gets in ahead of you. So you don't get all depressed because you know, first of all, that there's 5 minutes to the movie, so it's a difference. And second of all, it's just a line, like to the movie. So you're not there yet. You'll see him, whatever. So if that's how you look at life, these things don't challenge you. And then you ask yourself, well, how come he was fated to go in earlier and I was fated to go in left? Tzvi has an interesting story. Tzvi and I share a common story because I was in Smaros when the suicide bomber blew up. And I think a little while later, Tzvi was pulling up a car on King George Street when a suicide bomber blew himself up. And if he would have been there a minute later, a minute earlier, he wouldn't be here. That's the way life works, you know? Hashem just runs the plan, you know? And if you let go of the questions and you just give yourself over to it, nothing gets you depressed, you know? So that's a whole other discussion. Back to our show. So that's Tveria, okay? That's Tveria. Now, I want you to understand, we'll get to this in a minute, when you go over to the fence, by the way, on a clear day, you can actually see through the valleys, you can see Har Tavor, also in that direction. Har Tavor is the place where Dvora and Barak fought Yavin, the king of Canaan. That's right over there. Tavor means belly button. And there's a mountain that really looks like an Audi belly button. It's, by the way, proof that all the people with Audi belly buttons are really right, but that's another discussion. So that whole story from the book of Judges, amazing story, you know, and just in a nutshell, because it so fits with here, you know, the story of the book of Judges is a difficult story. Kind of also relates to this question. Okay, here's the basic plot, okay? Jews live in Israel. They're supposed to be doing whatever they're supposed to be doing, waking up in the morning, praying, saying Shema, putting on tefillin, keeping kosher, being basically ethical people. But then eventually they get fat and they get lazy and they stop doing what they're supposed to do. And they write their checks to the UJA, but they don't really show up to the synagogue, but they go to the JCC. Vayishman Yeshurun Vayivat. Yeshurun, one of the names of Jewish people, gets fat, starts to kick. So, you know, when the Jewish people aren't doing what they're supposed to be doing, someone always comes along to remind us. So some king comes along and subjugates us. Canaanites, Philistines, Edomites, whoever they are, right? So they subjugate us and life gets worse and they take our crops and they steal our daughters and it's just terrible and we cry out to God. So God sends a judge. And the judge is a hero. He could be Samson, he could be Gideon, right? He could be whoever, in this case Barak, right? And this person has in their hands the ability to save the Jewish people. He goes to war, fights the enemy, unbelievable, they vanquish the enemy, superior numbers, we win, life is good, we all daven, we say hallel, we love God and everything's great. And then gradually, right, then we eat. And then gradually, right, we start to forget again, and just this pattern happens, right? Jews get enslaved, God sends a judge, Jews are victorious, they pray, they say thank you, they eat, they get fat, they blow it, they go back to ideology, they get enslaved, again and again and again and again. So this is Act 13, scene the original, right? And Barak realizes that Yavin, the king of Canaan, is subjugating the Jewish people, they're suffering, something has to be done. So God comes to him and says you have to go to war. And Barak says, well basically God tells Devorah, who's a prophetess, right, to tell Barak he has to go to war. Barak, very interesting, no male ego here. Barak says, well listen, I'm not going to war without you. Like if you don't come and lead me, you're a prophetess, I want you there, you believe in God, everything's good. If you're with us, like God will help us out. Dvorah basically says, it's an amazing verse, you gotta look it up, I have a Tanakh if you wanna find it, with me. Dvorah basically says to him, you are such a wuss. What does it matter with you? God tells you you're gonna be okay, go out to battle, right, and fight for the Jewish people, right? Don't be a sissy, right? Barak says, I don't care what you say, call me a sissy if you want, you're coming along. If you're a prophetess and you talk to God, I figure it's gotta be good if you come with us. Dvorah says to him, well just know that if I come with you, everybody's gonna say that you were a sissy because you had to take Dvorah out with you to war. He says, fine, I'll be the sissy that won rather than the hero that died. Very, very deep message. Anyway, so they go out to meet the Canaanites. Now the problem is that the Canaanites have 600 chariots. Sound familiar? Chariots, right?
Yeah.
Hundreds of chariots. The chariot was the tank of the day. Imagine you're on foot and you have a sword, okay? And you have bow and arrow and you have spear, right? And you're here. And there's a chariot whose wheels come up to here, and it's got these sort of sword-like apparitions coming out of the wheel, right? And there's a fellow on top with an archer who's coming towards you probably close to 30 or 40 miles an hour, and it's led by two horses, right? And there's you. This is a terrifying thing. And if there's a guy with a long pike, or something similar, they had a longer sword, but not exactly sure what one. One guy on each side, one guy leading the chariots, they're on this side and they're just flailing away. So this was an unbelievable weapon of destruction. So the Jews had no hope. And all of a sudden they see all these chariots and they're surrounded by these chariots, so they start to run up the mountain. Because they figure if they get the high ground, what was true today is true then. He who controls the high ground, right, Sun Tzu, the art of war, controls strategic position. So they start to run for the high ground, and God sends a miracle. Do you know what the miracle was? It started to rain. Rain is always a blessing. Remember this story this afternoon when we're in Tzfat. Okay, remember this. It starts to rain. What happens when it rains on a mountainside in the Golan? It turns to mud. Who has a problem in the mud? Chariots. Jews turn around, all of a sudden the chariots are stuck in the mud. Somebody says, wait a second, these idiots are stuck in the mud. Oh, check it out, the idiots are stuck in the mud. They turn around, they run down, they make short work, right, of Sisera and his, you know, who's the general. Sisera actually escapes the battle. Sisera escapes the battle, runs down to the valley, gets to a Jewish village, right? Non-Jewish woman, okay, according to one opinion. That's a whole other discussion. Yael comes out. Yael sees Sisera. Now, she knows who Sisera is. It's kind of like knowing who, I don't know, Abu Mazen or Arafat is if you live around here. You know who they are. This is like chief nemesis number one. She can't believe it. Sisera. So she sees he's running. He's on foot. She figures out what must be happening. So she says, are you okay? Can I help you? His commandership, his holiness, his highness. So the commentaries say, how could Sisera be so stupid as to go and hide in a Jewish woman's home? How could she be so dumb? Answer, because if you're that arrogant, you actually believe it when somebody tells you you're the greatest. Even though you're an idiot. But okay. So Sisera goes and he hides in there, and Yael feeds him milk. Milk makes you sleepy. Which is why, by the way, giving milk and cereal to your children in the morning before school is a dumb idea. But we do it anyway. Okay. So she gives him milk. He falls asleep. She puts him to sleep. She says, oh, Matiko, whatever, reads him a little lullaby story. Once he falls asleep, she takes a tent peg and a hammer. Okay? Here lies Sisera's head. Here's the tent peg. Here's a hammer. Tent peg meets skull. Tent peg wins. Sisera dies. When the army comes looking for Sisera, she comes out and says, voila, and she's the heroine of the story. Okay? Interesting, this story is all about the women. Interesting. Another discussion. That happened, this whole story, and all the implications of the messages, which we could spend all day on, so many messages in the story, happened right over there in the fog. Okay? You can't see it, you just have to trust me that it's there. Alright? Mount Tabor. This is the period of the judges, you're talking about 3,200 years ago, 3,100 years ago. Yeah, that's a gazinta time. It's clearly this area that's the only mountain that looks exactly like a belly button. The Jews and the Arabs have a tradition about this mountain, so it makes sense. And they've actually found a lot of archaeological stuff there that date back a long time. Now that I've told you this, one more thing that I want you to notice when you go over to the overview again. Maybe you saw this already. You look over the fence and down. Did you notice there's a kibbutz there? Okay, you'll take a look. It's actually also a resort. It's called Kibbutz Ein Gev. So I didn't want to talk to you over there because I'm trying to save what's left. But that kibbutz, Ein Gev, was there before 1967. This is a kibbutz that was on this side of the Kinneret. They built this kibbutz not realizing what the Syrians would one day do. These people lived in bomb shelters. Unbelievable. How many shells fell on this kibbutz? The record number of shells that fell on this kibbutz in one day was 3,400 shells. 3,400 shells in a day, can you imagine? I mean, they shelled them from all over the line. They used to take target practice down there. And just amazing that this kibbutz stayed there. Okay? And they kept their act together, and eventually, when the Golan was freed, then Kibbutz Ein Gev became a resort. And now, it's tough to get in there, it's a beautiful sight, right on the sea, beautiful. There's the water park for the tourists in the south, at Tzemach, and there's the water park people don't know as much about, which is up a little further north, about 5 minutes drive, and that's where all the Americans don't go, so it's half empty, so that's where you want to go if you do a water park tour. And let's all agree that if nothing else comes out of this day, but you know where to go to a water park, it's been worth it. Okay, back to our story. 67, okay? First of all, where are we? Jerusalem, okay? Dead Sea, okay? If you're behind me and you can't see, then you gotta move, okay? Dead Sea. Yesterday, right, you came from Tel Aviv, okay, to the airport last week or 2 weeks ago. We spent time in Yerushalayim. We went down to the Dead Sea and drove along the Dead Sea to Mitzada, okay? South. This is a lot. Okay? This is today Egypt, but it's really the Sinai Desert. Okay? Right? The Gulf of Aqaba is here. It leads down to the Red Sea, which is there. Egypt. This is Jordan. All over here is Jordan. Okay?
today we came down here, but we turned left instead of right, all right, out of Jerusalem, and we came up the Jordan Valley. We came up the Jordan Valley to the Kinneret. This is Tzemach. This is the Sea of Galilee. Okay? We went up this way, to the left, to your left, and came up, and now we're here on the Golan Heights. This whole area here is known as the Golan Heights. Okay? The whole reason that Syria claims to be at war with us, okay, is because of the Golan Heights. Now this is Israel. Let me show you how big Jordan is. Jordan, if this is the size of Israel, goes out to about your knee. That's Jordan. It's about 2.5 times the size. Okay? Syria goes out, it's about double the size of Jordan. Syria probably goes out to about over here. Okay, you get this idea? Much, much bigger. Right? Didn't get a chance, but you can look up on so many. Go to honestreporting.com or go to the JNF site and you can see a map of Israel next to the Arab nations. It'll blow your mind.
Syria and Lebanon are...
Lebanon's over here. Lebanon actually is not much bigger than Israel. Lebanon is not such a big country. Lebanon, Iraq, Iran, Saudi Arabia down there, followed by Yemen and Tunisia and Morocco. Lots of fun places. Anyway. Now, in the Six-Day War, since the Syrian border, which was here, okay, and just to remind you, by the way, the West Bank is here, okay? This is the West Bank, basically, okay? Right? You saw we came across the fence to the West Bank, so that's why over here the fence is west of you, and when you drive over here, this is the belly of Israel. This is, by the way, Gush Katif. This is where Gaza is, okay? Here you have Tel Aviv, Haifa. This whole area is the belly of Israel. Okay? The overwhelming majority of Israel's population lives in this coastal plain. And the border, what would be the border, the fence as you call it, runs right here. And its closest spot today from an Israeli town, the fence is about 1,300 yards. Okay? 1,300 yards. Nothing. It's like from here to, maybe from here to that tree. Hey, you would see Kalkilia when you're driving on road number 6. That's how close you are at some places. Okay? And you're the same distance towards Farsama. So you're really talking about nothing. Okay, now let's talk about this story. Go on. Okay? 1973. Alright? After the Six-Day War in 1967, Israel came up on this side, they came up on this side, okay, and they conquered the Golan Heights. Now why is the Golan Heights so important? It's hard to explain when you're looking at a map. But I think you get it when you're sitting up here. This, by the way, was a Syrian gun position. In fact, you can still see, still here, over here, one of the Syrian guns. That Syrian gun used to sit right there, and that used to fire down. Okay, there's an 05 caliber machine gun, used to fire down on Ingev. That's how they tested their guns. Okay, you do what's called in an army position every morning, Nisu Kelim. You fire all your guns to make sure they're still working, right, every day. They used to do Nisu Kelim by aiming at things on Ingev. A little mind-boggling, but so be it. Right? And in 67 we took this over. Now comes 1973. I'm going to spare you the whole story of 1973 and what led up to that war. Later, if you're curious, I'll be glad to share it with you. Forces were building. There was a false call-up that the Syrians and the Egyptians orchestrated in May of 1973 because they wanted Israel to call up her reserves. Israel did, because if you take 70% of your army and you put it on Israel's border, Israel knows that it has to call up its reserves. Calling up the reserves, Israel cannot win a war with its standing army. The purpose of the standing army is to have enough forces to hold the line until the reserves can get there. That's the purpose of the standing army. Okay? That's the bottom line. And the Yom Kippur War was the perfect example. Okay? I'm not going to talk about troop numbers here because you never know where this information goes, especially if you're taping it. But suffice to say that the number of reserves is much, much, much more significant. Okay? And most of the standing army, never mind the reserves, right, was on the borders of Egypt and Syria in May of 1973. There was hell to pay for this because it turned out to be a false alarm. It was just a maneuver. How could Israeli intelligence think there was a war coming? It was just a maneuver. How could you call us all up? How could we miss our jobs and get our business meetings canceled and lose our product line and everything else that happens when an entire country stops? So when warnings started coming through in September of 1973, people were very hesitant to do something with them because they couldn't do this again. Israel's economy couldn't stand it, let alone politics. In October of 1973, I'm going to explain to you what saved the war in 1973. But before we get to that piece, okay, because that will do on the bus and air condition, in 1973, along this border, which is here, you can see this is Syria, the pink, and this is Israel.
The
blue border is Syria?
At
pink.
This, pink.
I see.
At exactly 2 o'clock in the afternoon on Yom Kippur. Yom Kippur is the holiest fast day of the Jewish year. It's the day, especially back in 73, when more Israelis are fasting, and therefore weakest than any other day. It's the hottest part of the day, and it's hot up here in September, October, right? It's the day, interestingly enough, where the sun is almost overhead, and eventually the sun will start to set. Where does the sun set? When the sun sets in the west, it's in the eyes of the people who are coming from that direction, from Syria. So they have to get across before the sun gets into their eyes. And that's why they do it at 2 o'clock in the afternoon instead of 5 o'clock in the afternoon. Okay? So they figure this is the optimum time to attack. 2,000 tanks cross the border. This border. Now, at that time, there were 2 chativot, there were 2 brigades holding this line. That's about 150 tanks. There was only 1 gdud, 1 battalion, which wasn't even in full strength, which was about 25 tanks. It was actually ready with their equipment in the tanks, camouflage tents off, and everything ready to go. That's because on the morning of Yom Kippur, there was an intense artillery barrage. And Yanush, the commander of the 7th Brigade, and I'm going to tell you their story a little later, Yanush, the commander of the 7th Brigade, smelled something was up, and so he decided to move one of his battalions up onto the line, even though he had no orders to do so. That move, now I have to tell you, there are 2 dimensions to this story. There's what's happening on the ground, and that's how we have to look at the story, and then there's what's happening upstairs. So I just want you to understand when we're finished with the story, that in my mind, there's no way that this story works unless there's an upstairs. I don't personally get it. And by the time I'm done, you may or may not share the same opinion. What's fascinating to me is that this is one of the few stories you meet people who were there who define themselves as totally secular. How you define a human being as secular is another question. How a person wearing an Israeli army uniform could ever be defined as secular is another question. But that's okay. But putting that aside, I've met guys who are avowedly anti-religious, don't believe in God, claim they don't believe in God. He says, except for Yom Kippur in 73. That day I could see there might have been a God. But, you know, since then, whatever, I like the beach too much, so fate. But anyway, 2,000 tanks. 25 tanks hold the line. That decision to send that unit up on the line will be one of the decisions that saves the state of Israel. Okay? Shouldn't work. Shouldn't make sense. Now, by the way, putting aside that story, which we're going to have to get to, I'll tell you an interesting military detail. There's such a thing as a battle zone. And there are actually military definitions for a battle zone. Now, what's a battle zone? A battle zone basically is, let's say for a field of battle, you actually call it probably in English, Shdekav. Let's say you have your frontline troops, right? Like, let's say, I don't know, I'm a company commander, and I'm with my company, and we're fighting Syrian tanks, God forbid, over here. And my battalion commander, he's a little further back, because he's controlling 3 companies, he's got to keep an eye on them. And then you've got the brigade headquarters, that's a little further back. And then you've got division headquarters, right? And then you've got the artillery. The artillery actually is all the way in the rear. Today, artillery has a range of approximately 25, really closer to 20 miles. So what's the distance from the rear echelon, the artillery, and the division headquarters, right? Because why put the artillery in harm's way where they can be bombed if you can put them back as far back as you can, right? The distance that it takes for a field of battle is about 25 miles. In other words, from the artillery guns in the rear to the frontline battle troops is 25 miles. Okay? So if I have a 25-mile area, okay, my frontline troops are going to be on one end and my rear troops are going to be on another end. And this is a very important detail to know. Because, for example, let's say they're moving up artillery guns. If their artillery guns are 40 miles away, I know that they're not in the range of my front lines. As soon as they move to 25 miles, I know that they have artillery range. Now, here's what's interesting. Okay? The shortest, the narrowest spot in the Golan, which is here, is 9 kilometers. 9 kilometers wide is about, let's say, 5 miles is 9 kilometers, give or take, 5 miles. Okay? So, if this is the Golan, and the artillery, the Syrian border is here, this is the field of battle. Tveria is in the field of battle. All the kibbutzim are in the field of battle. In other words, this is a buffer zone. They're already starting with a head start. We're already behind the game in that this Golan is our buffer zone. It's a very serious issue. If you move this line to over here, then this becomes the battle zone. And if you allow the Syrians down below into the Kinneret, right, then Afula enters the battle zone. That's the problem. The problem that we have in Israel is there just isn't enough room. Not that there isn't enough room for people to live together. There isn't enough room to lose a war. We do not have the option to lose a war. That's our problem. Okay? So what happened in the Yom Kippur War? So I'll tell you one story, and then we'll get back on the bus. This is a crazy story. This is a story that makes no sense. But it is the beginning of a larger, crazier story. Rosh Hashanah, 1973. Intelligence reports are starting to filter in of large troop movements. And the Israelis don't yet have accurate intelligence that Syria and Egypt have already gotten together and decided to break out of war on the exact same day and the exact same minute. Sadat, right, in 67, okay, and now in 73, Nasser was in 67. Sadat has been dreaming about reclaiming Arab pride, about recapturing what was taken and driving the Jews into the sea. And this is finally going to be his opportunity. And he's been training for this, right? There are a number of problems here. Problem number one is that Israel has just fought the Six-Day War, just 6 years earlier. So we're not just good. We're damn good. Right? I mean, we didn't just fight a war. We took them out in 6 days. We knocked out the entire Egyptian Air Force in 3 hours. There was nothing left. There were Israeli generals sitting in command posts eating lollipops. Yeah, is there a war on? Yeah, I think so. Yeah, yeah, take Hebron. Yeah, there are any Arabs there. So this is a very dangerous state of mind to be in. To be so cocky that you think that you're unbeatable. Okay? And the Arabs were about to teach us that lesson in a very painful way. Okay? So we didn't know that, but intelligence started to filter in. Now, if you didn't have that attitude, and if you hadn't had that false call up in May, and you looked at the intelligence reports, you'd be nervous. You'd at least move some troops up. But there are a number of different things happening, all sorts of different legends. We now know that Golda Meir received a CIA report in 1973 that suggested, as late as September, I think 27th, 28th, as late as the end of September, that Israel was going to come under battle and that a war was brewing and that it was going to start any day. And Golda Meir called up the State Department, Henry Kissinger, said to him, listen, I have a report here in my hands that tells me from your CIA that there's going to be a war. Now, this is 6 years after Israel had massive troop buildups on its border. In May of 67, Israel was forced to call up all of its reserves. The country ground to a halt. The economy was floundering. And finally, after all hearing all the Arab airwaves, we're going to push the Jews into the sea, we're going to give them the state of Israel under the Mediterranean and all this kind of stuff, Israel saw the war coming. Nasser had kicked out the UN observers in the Sinai, had moved up full divisions on the border. Israel finally decided, you know what, we can't wait for them to start the war. Because if they start the war on the 67 borders, official Israeli reports, if they start the war on the 67, pre-67 borders, there's going to be nothing left of the state of Israel. So Israel starts the war instead. June 6, 1967, the Israeli Air Force, in actually three sorties, sets out for the air. They take Egypt out first. They fly underneath the radar of most of the SAM-6 sites. They take out 80 planes in the first sortie, 130 planes in the second sortie. By the end of the morning, the entire Egyptian Air Force is just piles of smoke. They then set flight for Syria. They knock out the Syrian Air Force in much the same fashion, although they lose a few planes to the SAM sites, to the anti-aircraft SAM sites. And by the afternoon of the first day of the war, Israel has complete, uncontested air superiority. And it just goes downhill from there, right? Or uphill, depending on your perspective, right? So in 1973, that's what Kissinger's afraid of. Kissinger says, you can't do that. If you start the war this time, I'm not going to be able to help you. Because you're already the aggressor after the Six-Day War. You have to let them fire the first shot. Can you imagine? And you kind of step back from this, and this is now generally accepted knowledge, you take a step back and you look and say, this is ridiculous. This is like your son is in the schoolyard, and there's a big bully, and he's like 40 years old, and he's a power builder. And you tell your kid, say, listen, you know, just a couple weeks ago, you got into an argument with this guy, and you spilled boiling water on him. And you just took him out, right? You ever spilled boiling water on a guy's face, like he's looking around, and then you knocked him over, and you were like the hero. You can't do that again, because they're calling you a violent kid. Can you imagine? Right? So you have to wait until he slams you. Then, you'll be the underdog, you can fight back. But they have this dialogue. Now, Golda Meir knows a fact that is not so public even today, which is that Israel cannot fight a sustained war without American intervention, especially of spare parts. America sells us her military, you know, F-16s is a great example, but they do not sell us enough spare parts to sustain those F-16s for a lengthy period of time. And they do this for two reasons. One is economic, because they want us dependent on their military industry, so they'll have to buy, because we supply jobs to America. Cannot imagine how many hundreds of thousands of people are living off Israel's military acquisitions, right? And the second reason is because if we're ever fighting war, we're going to run out of parts, and we're going to need America to give them to us. And America is quite happy that we're dependent on America, because then they can get all sorts of things in return. Golda Meir knows that if she fights a sustained war in 1973, she will need airlift to America in 3 weeks. And if Kissinger says he's not going to send them, even if we start the war, we won't be able to sustain it. So she listens to him. She also listens to her commanders who tell us the war is not so imminent. And they're all wrong. And in 2,000 tanks crossed the border here. Thousands of tanks, men and personnel, crossed the Suez Canal. We're not going to get to that story because that's a long drive. And at this point, oh yeah, it's pretty much an act of war. Yeah, 2,000 tanks crossed the border. We're at war, right? Yep, that's an act of war. In Rosh Hashanah of 1973, in Russia, I'm not making fun, I'm just having a good time.
No, that's my point. I'm trying to make a point of God.
Right. In Rosh Hashanah, pardon?
You know what the date was?
October 6th.
Yom Kippur?
Yeah. The 6th of October of Yom Kippur, the 6th of October of 1973, is a national holiday in Egypt, to this day. Huge military parades to celebrate the Yom Kippur War. Okay? I want you to know this is a very interesting thing. If you look at October 6th in this country, now by the way, at the end of the day, we won this war. Not only did we win this war, we surrounded the entire Egyptian 8th Army, we bombed Cairo, we surrounded and took out most of the Syrian divisions, and we bombed Damascus. And they had to sue us for a ceasefire. So we won the war. There's no victory parade in Israel on October 6, 1973, because we also lost 1,800 men. In Egypt alone, okay, over 15,000 men were killed. But there's a big victory parade. That in and of itself is a cultural window into the challenges of making peace with people who have a completely different perception of reality. Not to say it's not possible, just to represent the challenges. Back to our story. Rosh Hashanah, the 7th Brigade. The 7th Brigade is along, you can't see it on this map, right around sort of where David's head is along the Suez Canal. That's where they're based. They're actually in a rear base. And his unit gets a week off, called a Rigila, for the holiday of Rosh Hashanah, the Shabbos after it, in a couple of days. And if you're a brigade commander and you get a week off, on your way home, you stop off at military command headquarters in Tel Aviv, and you just get an update, you know, intelligence, whatever. Back then, they weren't on the internet. He stops by brigade headquarters, national military headquarters, the Kiryat, and he gets an update, and he starts looking at all the intelligence reports. He starts looking at all the intelligence reports, he's seeing things like the fact that there's a huge military buildup. He's seeing things like the fact that on the front end of the Egyptian positions on the Suez Canal, they had begun to dug canals down into the canal itself, it could only be used to move landing craft down into the water. The fact that they had now put bridges, they had stockpiled bridges right behind their positions, which Egypt claimed was a military maneuver, but when they counted them from the air, and the intelligence reports suggested that they now have enough to cross over the Suez Canal, all sorts of stuff like that. Like the fact that there are now 2,000 tanks there, actually 2,400 tanks massed on the border. Like the fact that the entire headquarters of military command has moved from Damascus up to the border with Israel. Like the fact that the artillery guns have now multiplied tenfold along the border with Israel. All these intelligence reports. Things that they had never seen yet in a maneuver, except for May, which is what freaked the Jews out and why the Israelis made their call up. And Yavuz looks at this and he says, you know what? There's going to be a war. So he gets a meeting with his commander, the commander of the Ugdanel division commander, and he says to him, listen, look at these intelligence reports. There's going to be a war. We got to do something. We got to call up the reserves. Talk to the chief of staff. Talk to Dado. Right? David Elazar was then chief of staff. The division commander says, listen, we went through this in May. We can't do this. I've already said that I'm nervous about this. They say they're nervous. They have more intelligence than we do. It's not happening. Janosch is a bit of a nut. He's known as a womanizer, as a firebrand. He's a little bit off his rocker. To this day, people say that about him. Right? He's not with us anymore. But he's a military genius. He looks at these maps. He says, there's going to be a war, and it's happening now. We need to do something. He screams all day, spends the whole day in the Kiryat, finally gets an appointment with Dado Elazar, says to him, you have to call up the reserves. Elazar's response is, look, you know, I only took this meeting because, Ditka said that he wanted me to take the meeting. I don't have time for this, and you're right, but, you know, don't worry about it. We know the intelligence, not happening right now, whatever it might be, right?
Yanush says, there's going to be a war. Elazar says, look, we saw the same thing in May. These are how their maneuvers are working. Dadu says to him, idiot. Now, you don't call the Ramatkal chief of staff an idiot if you're a brigade commander. Right? Brigade commander is like, how do I describe this to you? Everything in the army works in threes. A squad is like, you know, eight guys. Right? There are three squads in a platoon. Platoon is like, let's say, 25 guys. Okay? Then there's three platoons in a company. That's like 100 guys. That's me, company commander. Then you have three companies in a battalion with all the support personnel. That's about like 500 men. Then you have like three battalions in a brigade. That's Yanush. So you're talking about like 1,500, 2,000 men. It's a serious commander. But there are, now we can't talk about numbers, there are numbers of brigades and divisions, there are a number of divisions in an army, there are X number of armies in the Israeli army, and then you have Dadu Elazar. So it's like you're talking to God. You don't call God an idiot, unless you're Yanush. So Elazar hears this, he's not used to being talking like this by his brigade commanders. He says, well, I may be an idiot, but you're finished. Goodbye. Right? They're done. And Yanush can't believe it. And he says to him, you're crazy. Would you ever think that maybe they planned this thing in May so that now, when they're ready to start a war, we wouldn't call up our reserves? Anyway, his pleas fall on deaf ears. They will not call up the reserves. He finally decides, you know what? I can't get them to change what they're doing in the army, but I can definitely do what I want with my own brigade. So he decides that he's going to move his brigade. Because down in the Sinai, there's a buffer zone of 120 miles from the Suez Canal up to the Sinai until you get to Beersheba. So at least they have a few days where the tanks are moving, they can fight back. But in the Golan, like I just demonstrated, I mean, this is 20 minutes in a tank to the Kinneret. And it's an hour in a tank to Tveria. And it's 2.5 hours to Haifa, and maybe 4 hours to Tel Aviv, 3 hours to Jerusalem. You know? I mean, if the tanks break through and there's nobody up here in a day, we're finished. All this is now Syria. You understand that? It's crazy. So he screams bloody murder until they finally agree to let him move his brigade from the Suez Canal to the Golan. Now, realize that this happens on the eve of Rosh Hashanah. His whole brigade has just been given the week off. Go find everybody the week off. Much as I'd like to tell you that all these guys are in shul on Rosh Hashanah morning, it's not exactly true. So they have to comb the beaches of Israel. It's not a simple thing. But because they're in the regular army, not in the reserves, they have, you know, phone numbers and they have whatever. Anyway, it takes 4 days. They finally call up the entire unit. Some of them have to go all the way back down to Sinai, which is like a, you know, 15-hour trip to get the tanks and the equipment and bring them back up. Basically, 2 days before Yom Kippur, the 7th Brigade arrives in the Golan. And they're arrayed alongside the 188th. Now, because Yanush does this, there are two brigades and not one on the day the Yom Kippur War breaks out. The 188th Brigade was completely wiped out. Remember, they were the guys who were in the Golan. They were already fixed positions there. They had their own gear. They were much more set up. So they ended up fighting, with the exception of one battalion, before the 7th were getting their act together. They were completely wiped out. The brigade commander was killed. The deputy commander was killed. Two out of three of the battalion commanders were killed. The chief of intelligence of the brigade was killed. Out of the 300 men of the brigade, when the war ended, okay, over 220 of them were killed, and the remainder were almost all wounded. There were only 11 men from an entire brigade. An entire brigade that were not killed or wounded in the Yom Kippur War. They had to rebuild it from scratch. Now imagine if the 7th Brigade hadn't been there. Then basically 6 hours into the war, there would have been no one up here. There would have been 11 guys holding off 2,000 tanks. So you ask yourself, so what makes a guy like Yanush do something like that? Where does that come from? I don't know. Certain people, they're just put in the right place at the right time. Hashem has strange messengers. This guy was beloved to many women in Israel. And he got to know many of them all over the beaches of Israel. And there were scandals about him in the newspaper. And yet he was in the right place at the right time, saw something coming, made a decision that put him in the field of fire, that changed the course of destiny for the entire state of Israel. So some of the stories of the Yom Kippur War, the battles of the Yom Kippur War, and how this war was fought, and where the men fell, is what we're going to see this morning. Okay? So we're going to take a drive to a forward position where I can tell you the unfolding of one battle story, because telling you the story of the whole Yom Kippur War would be just too much to tell. I will tell you that there are two books, somebody just asked me this question, that I find to be the most powerful books, although there are many that are written. One of them is The Eve of Destruction, The War of Atonement, which was written by Chaim Herzog, who was chief of intelligence of the Israeli army in the 48 war, and eventually became the president of Israel. He had privy to a lot of this information. And the second, which is written more as a story, is The Eve of Destruction by Howard Blum. And it's really about the story of Yossi Ben Hanan, whose story I'll tell you a little later. Two amazing books to read. Anyway, food for thought. There's lots more to talk about. Any questions?
Yeah.
Yes.
Where on the map were we when we were late, when we went to the bathroom in that?
Oh,
series?
Okay, good. Yeah. This is the Kinneret. We went along the Kinneret. This is Jordan. That's the yellow. The pink is Syria. The white is Israel. Look at the point where they meet. Right? Remember, we went along here. I said, that's Jordan. Now you're looking at Syria? Okay? So that's where Hamad Gader is. When you looked ahead, you saw Syrian. When you looked to the right, you saw Jordanian. And when you look behind you, you saw Israel. Cool?
Well,
they should have at least called up all the reserves, but it's easy to look at hindsight.
What was the whole name?
There's a famous story. There was one guy in the Kiryah who was a major, which is pretty low in those circles, who was convinced the war was breaking out, and he tried and tried and tried. He screamed to everybody who would listen, and no one listened to him. He subverted orders and went behind the head of military intelligence back to inform some of the units of what he thought was going on, and he got into trouble, and he was... And later, of course, after the war, he became, you know, exonerated, and they wanted to demote him. And they did a dry run of what they were planning. 1973, the Syrians and the Egyptians.
Okay.
They did it in May. It was a dry run. It was a call-up.
Okay.
They wanted to see that they could do it. What they didn't realize, some people say they planned it this way, was that this dry run would cause Israel to call up all her reserves. So once they did that, they kept their troops there for quite a while.
Okay.
Because, you know, they had a lot more money than we do. And because they kept their troops there, eventually, you know, the UN had to get involved, the US had to get involved.
So we thought.
So in 1973, we couldn't be sure they weren't doing the same thing, and it cost us a tremendous amount.
What year was it?
Go take a look at Ein Gev, and you'll see, and then we're going to get back on the bus. Okay? Cool? There's, by the way, there's a gorgeous teal. There's a path that you take. It starts over there. You can actually see a little piece of it. And it winds down the side of the mountain, and you can walk all the way down to the beach and get. It's gorgeous. In fact, here, you can see it right here. That's part of it. And this is amazing. Look at that. That's Ein Gev. Look at that. Like, you could throw a rock there. That's the kibbutz, and that's the, like, the guest house hotel area. Israelite! Yell out, Israelite, we're heading for the bus.
Israelite, we're heading for the bus!
This presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman has been brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To access additional presentations from our online media library, order our best-selling books, or learn more about Israelite programming, including seminars, web-based learning, teleconferences, spiritual retreats, Shabbaton experiences, Israel missions, and leadership training, please visit us at www.israelite.org. That's www.israelight.org. You can also call us in New York at 212-947-4990 or in Jerusalem at country code 972-2-627-4890. We hope you enjoyed this presentation, and we look forward to learning with you at Israelite.